Good evening. First thing I'd like to say to you tonight, in addition to Roy welcoming you and thanking you for being here, and for our students in particular, although they'll be with us on Wednesday, will not be with us for the next couple of Sundays, and we want to wish them a very happy Thanksgiving as well as for everyone. But first thing I'd like to mention about this topic is, number one, it is intended for me. And then, number two, it is intended for you. That is to say, whatever the Bible teaches on any topic speaks to us where we are. And there are times where there are some things that apply to us more than others. But at some time in life, we're going to find that whatever our situation, expected or unexpected, the Bible speaks to it. Excuse me, I'm not in the mistreatment business, and you are not either. But there are letters I wish that I had not sent. There are emails that I wish I had deleted instead of sending. And there are texts that I wish even that I had not sent, maybe because of some situation at the time. And there are other regrets, you know, that we all have. But I want us tonight to look at what Peter is saying about this matter of when you are mistreated. And we've all been there, and we will be there again, and we have been there in terms of mistreating, not only mistreated. Someone has said that there are really only two ways in which you grow. One is through the people that come into your life. You are constantly learning from people. For instance, I want you to think about the tremendous influence, the life-changing influence that your grade school teachers had on you. I mean, going all the way back, well, for some of us, kindergarten hadn't been invented yet, but going all the way back for those of you that were in kindergarten all the way forward, think about junior high or middle school, high school, college, people we've worked with and so forth. We learn from people. Get these names. I think I've run through them with you before, but my grade school teachers, all of which were members of the church, Miss Josie, Miss Sudie, Miss Myrtle, Miss Grace, Miss Bridie, Miss Gladys, and Miss Maud, that was through seven, until we finally had a cool young guy, 25 years old, who was a coach, named Joe Don. And we thought he was the coolest thing in the world because these others were nearing retirement. And how long has it been since you've heard of Josie or Sudie or Myrtle or Maud? I mean, no Jan or Joan at all in all of that group or names like that. But they changed me forever. And I cannot remember, I cannot forget the names because I cannot remember the people. Even the challenges of the very first grade. But then you think about the lessons you've learned from pain. That's the second way. And pain comes, of course, in as many ways as there are people. The Scottish poet Robert Browning said it this way: I walked a mile with pleasure. She chattered all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. But I walked a mile with sorrow, and ne'er a word said she. But oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. What hurts is, in fact, what hurts the most, is when the pain that we have in life is from people that we have in life. That is to say, the greatest hurts, the greatest pains. And so we want to be sure that as the children of God, we're not being like the world. We're trying to show the world what it's like as a child of God to respond to situations and to people, whether in the church or outside of the church, in the family or outside of the family, how we respond when we have mistreatment. We really cannot look at the text. Chance, you did a super job in reading this text. Thank you I'm sorry, I've got the lapel on, so I can't look down too much. I want us to look, I want you to look, before we get into the points that Peter is making here about Jesus. Look back at verse 18 of 1 Peter chapter 2. And if you just want to listen along, that's fine. But I'm going to read to you three verses to give you the background of where this text is coming. Because the Bible always speaks to real life situations. And here he's talking to first century saints who happened to be slaves in the days of the Roman Empire, when, before the days of the Roman Empire, there were not that many slaves in the world. But by the time the Romans had their way conquering everybody, the number was at 60 million. Most of the people who were attracted to the Lord and most of the people who were added to the church were those who came from such a background. That is why Paul talks about masters and servants on at least two different occasions in Ephesians and Colossians. That is why that Peter, and by the way, this month's emphasis on the Apostle Peter reminds me again of how, because we have so much more material from Paul, we're often talking about the greatness of Paul. But let's not forget the greatness of Peter. Beginning not only with the gospel story, but in particular the first gospel sermon in Acts 2. And then this seasoned elder in the church, as well as an apostle and preacher, who by the time that he reaches his last years, writes these two marvelous letters of inspiration. He says, "Servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. For this finds favor, if for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly." Notice, those who suffer unjustly, this promise says, has the attention especially of Almighty God. Boy, I love a God like that, don't you? And this is one of the reasons why that we do love Him so much. For what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? But if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this is what finds favor with God. Did you catch that? If you suffer for something that you have done wrong, that's one thing. But if you suffer for something that is right, that is what finds favor with God. Okay, here we go. In the next verse, Peter talks about, well, our opening slide said, you've been called for this purpose. Remember, he's talking to slaves, literal slaves. You and I do not have a clue, really. A slave did not belong to themselves. They did not own their own body. They did not own their own life. They did not own the air in which they breathed. Everything belonged to their master. And he is saying, you've been called for this purpose. What purpose is that? Since Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. Speaking of the first grade, this word example is a very interesting word. It refers to how a child is taught to write. Do you remember those first grade writing tablets when it came writing time in the day? How that there was the perfect line of the ABCs up there at the top of the page, and underneath each one, you had to copy it. That's what the word means. Okay, you have this perfect example. You have this perfect standard. And from that standard, you are, to the best of your ability, dedicate yourself to being a copy of that standard. Now, I tell you where a lot of us are. We hear things like that, and we say, listen, come on. Be real. Who can be like Jesus in anything? I mean, who can be like Jesus in any way, one who was tempted in all points, yet without sin. In fact, the statement that he makes here, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. What hurts the most is when we suffer or we're mistreated innocently. I have a list of things here that, let's see if you can identify with at least one. It is much harder to accept the pain that others inflict upon us, especially when that pain is deliberate, when it is premeditated, and when it is personally directed against us. Maybe it is a boss who absolutely hates you, keeps you employed because maybe he or she has to, but who really dislikes you to the point of hatred. Hatred, remember, that is a form of mistreatment. Co-workers who envy you. Have you had those? Are you with those now? Seems like there's nothing that you can do, but they're going to envy whatever it is that you do, whatever that you have, whatever accomplishment and so forth. Envy. Incredible problem. Maybe it's a spouse who is so critical that they can never be satisfied or pleased. What about betrayal? What about lies? What about false accusations, slander, gossip, violence, fraud, being robbed, deceit, unfair treatment, unfair punishment, humiliation, ridicule, sarcasm, rumors? Oh, don't you love this one? The silent treatment. Mockery, being called vile names and being made the butt of cruel jokes. Yes, the pain like that comes from those people who are in our lives and who mean the pain deliberately. Obviously, we can bring pain accidentally and unintentionally. And sometimes we do not know. We do not know that something that we thought was pretty humorous hurt somebody's feelings really, really bad. And when we hear about it, then we are really sorry. In this verse about innocence, notice Peter being a student of the Old Testament. This passage is filled with echoes, if not direct statements, from Isaiah 53, the great passage that 750 years before the coming of the Lord, Isaiah gave us a preview, a portrayal, if you please, of what the crucifixion was going to be like. And you know, as the Lord came into the world, and as he became aware of, even in a human sense, his being the Son of God and what his mission was, what his task was, you think he didn't know Isaiah 53 word for word by heart? Well, of course, he knew that before he even came to the earth. And yet he says, Father, I will go. I will go. And I will die for the sins of the world because it's the only way. It's the only hope. And so we're to follow an example like that. I want you to think of others, particularly in the Old Testament, in addition to Jesus in the New Testament, who suffered and were mistreated unfairly, unjustly. All you have to do, again, is to read the beautiful and yet tragic story until it gets to the really good part of Joseph. How could a kid brother be so hated that first the idea was to murder him and then one brother saved him to be sold into slavery? Think about David. Through no fault of his own, yes, being favored by God because at the time he was a young man after God's own heart, is pursued constantly by your own father-in-law, the king of Israel, who is supposed to be the spiritual leader of the people, throws a javelin at you and wants to nail you to the wall, kill you, and then has hundreds of thousands of men out looking for you. Constantly on the run. Anything fair about that? Anything just about that? And then I want to think about Daniel. What a tremendous hero Daniel is, as we have studied before, and how that in his Persian and Babylonian imprisonment, that he is faithful to God as Joseph was, as David was, and how that even with that, he's thrown into a den of lions with the idea of him being quickly consumed. How in the world could one human be treated like that? How in the world could the Romans be so heartless that the history of the famed Roman Colosseum is filled with a number of lives that were torn to pieces, the lives of saints torn to pieces among other ways of execution that could very well be numbered in this group that he's calling servants. And the word servant is not strong enough. Literally, slavery. The Bible does not try to either condemn or condone slavery. It provides the principles like this of how to beat it. And you know, when it comes to mistreatment, the way that we are supposed to beat it, in the words of Paul as well as others, pour coals of fire upon the one who is guilty. So is it possible for us to really be like Jesus? Many of you are familiar with a gentleman's poem by the name of Kent Keith. Kent Keith, according to research, for a long time this was unknown, but it has been discovered that Kent Keith is the original author of this poem called Anyway. People are often unreasonable, illogical, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of being selfish, ulterior motives, but you be kind to them anyway. If you are successful, you will win some false friends and some true enemies. Succeed anyway. If you are honest and frank, people may cheat you, but be honest and frank anyway. What you spend years building, someone else can destroy overnight. Build anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, they may be jealous, but you be happy anyway. The good you do today, people will often forget, sometimes absolutely forget, within 24 hours. But you do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give the world the best you have anyway. You see, in the final analysis, it is between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. That is so incredibly true. Sometimes we suffer innocently, but we have an example of one who responded in the way that he would have us to respond. How did he do that? Sometimes we suffer or we're mistreated patiently, or we meet it with patience. Boy, that's hard. That is really hard. Here's the text from 1 Peter 2:23. While being reviled, a word that really means insulted, he did not revile or insult in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats. But here's the key. Why? Because he kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. You know what that means? He knew that time was short, and eternity is forever. And the only way to be assured of eternity, even as a child of God with God in heaven, is to be able to endure that which is only for a time with patience. Like Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13:4, the very first quality that he gives for love, love is patient. And you know, when you ask someone who's been married 60 or more years, that's what they will say. Roy and I were visiting a number of years ago with a couple visiting their 50th wedding anniversary, and we asked the bride, what in the world is the secret to living with this guy for 50 years? She says, a whole lot of patience and a whole lot of forgiveness. Well, he could probably say the same thing. What did Jesus teach in the Sermon on the Mount about response? Do you remember right there in the heart, really near the end of Matthew chapter 5, and he goes through a series of statements. You have heard it said, but I say unto you, love your neighbor but hate your enemies, but I say unto you that you love your neighbor and your enemies. And already we're wondering, all right, now who does that? It's not just who does that, who can do that? Of course, he's using the word for love that is agape, which means you treat them right, even if they're your enemy. You play by the rules. Like if you're a soldier in war, you remember the rules of war. If you're an athlete, you remember the rules of war, even athletics, even at the expense of your own, perhaps, welfare at the time. You do what is right. So that's the word love that he's using. He's not going to say we're going to be best friends or family members forever, but that we are to love with agape love. Now, he then gives these principles that seem to be impossible. Okay, if someone loses control, that's providing commentary now, but this is the background of what he's talking about. If someone momentarily loses control, let's say in a discussion, and strikes you on the cheek, then you turn the other cheek as well. The idea is non-retaliation in an effort to keep something escalating into potential violence, which happens every day in these United States and around the world, many times a day. The escalation of words that turns into violence doesn't justify it at all, but it's the cause. And then he says, if you owe someone something and they take you to court because you cannot pay them, and they have the right to take you to court, and they can take your coat literally off your body, you offer him your overcoat as well, which is what the cloak meant. That is what the cloak word in Matthew 5 is referring to, which the Old Testament taught you cannot take from someone. Often that is the very last item they own. You cannot demand that. He said, I know the law says that, but you offer it to them anyway. You can say, well, that's great psychology, but it's really great theology, because more than likely the person could be touched to the fact, forget the whole thing. I'm not going to take your cloak by law, but if you're willing to give it, I don't even want to take your coat. And then he says, if you are required to carry a burden for a mile for someone else, you be willing to carry it too. Those are the principles that he gives, and this is the way he says, when you are mistreated, and there was not a Jew who would not have been mistreated if a Roman soldier comes along and says, you carry my armor, I'm tired, for a mile. Sir, I'll be happy to carry it too. Revolutionary thinking. Revolutionary teaching. That if employed, would change the world. And not only that, would change the church. And we would not have the hurts and the squabbles and the divisions that we so often have, even within a church body, even to the point of some folks saying, well, I'm going to take my ball and go somewhere else and play. I'm going to go to church somewhere else. I'm not going to go here anymore. Now, they may be at fault with that particular attitude. But what if we could remove the problem from the very beginning, is the idea. I'd like to ask you to do something outside the service because we don't have time. But some of the best words of inspiration that probably we ought to read every day. But I want you to go home tonight. I want you to promise that before the day is over, that you will read Romans 12, 9 to 21, less than 5 minutes. You know, it's the passage that begins, love without hypocrisy. In honor preferring other people. You know, let other people get the honor. You don't have to have the honor. Let other people have the honor. You've got a good life. It doesn't matter how much attention is called to you. I mean, really. And then it ends with, be not overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. You think all of this is make-believe? I mean, it would not be emphasized in Scripture if it were not possible to do. The problem is, we just don't try. We want to stay, you know, like we are. Well, I can't help reacting the way, if you knew my mama, if you knew my daddy, or if you knew my great-grandmama, you would understand why I am the way I am. Well, listen, it could be somebody else's fault. You are the way you are. It's your fault if you stay that way. Because you are taught better by the Word of God. And then thirdly, he talks about suffering sacrificially. I said we didn't have time to read that passage because I really do want to read to you some information you may not have heard before. I know we're all familiar with the cross, but I'd like for you to kind of remember as much of this as you possibly can the next time on the Lord's Day, that when we're in the middle of worship and we're partaking of the Lord's Supper, as we have the honor to do every first day of the week, as the Bible teaches, there is a picture of a cross upon the screen, and it's there for a reason. Like we can really focus our minds. We know what happened on the cross, we just cannot imagine. Dr. C. Truman Davis, a number of years ago, really a number of decades ago, in the Bible Expositors, or the Expositor's Bible Dictionary, Volume 8, a Christian medical doctor, writes about what a physical description of crucifixion is. And I'm going to read this to you. It's about four paragraphs, if you'll just bear with me. The cross is placed on the ground, and the exhausted man is quickly thrown backwards with his shoulders against the wood. The legionnaire, the Roman soldier, feels for the depression at the front of the wrist. He drives a heavy square wrought iron nail through the wrist and deep into the wood. Quickly he moves to the other side and repeats the action, being careful not to pull the arms too tightly but to allow some flex and movement. The cross is then lifted into place. The left foot is pressed backward against the right foot, and with both feet extended, toes down, a nail is driven through the arch of each foot, leaving the knees flexed. The victim is now crucified. As he slowly sags down with more weight on the nails and the wrists, excruciating, fiery pain shoots along the fingers and up the arms to explode in the brain. The nails in the wrists are putting pressure on the median nerves. As he pushes himself upward to avoid this stretching torment, he places the full weight on the nail through his feet. Again, he feels the searing agony of the nail tearing through the nerves between the bones of the feet. As the arms fatigue, cramps sweep through the muscles, knotting them in deep, relentless, throbbing pain. With these cramps comes the inability to push himself upward to breathe. Air can be drawn into the lungs but not exhaled. And so he fights to raise himself up in order to get even one small breath of air. Finally, carbon dioxide builds up in the lungs and in the bloodstream, and cramps partially subside. Spasmodically, he is able to push himself upward to exhale and to bring in some life-giving oxygen. Hours of this limitless pain, cycles of twisting, joint-rending cramps, intermittent partial asphyxiation, searing pain as tissue is torn from his lacerated back, he moves up and down against the rough timber. Then another agony begins, a deep crushing pain deep in the chest as the pericardium slowly fills with serum and begins to compress the heart. It is now almost over. The loss of tissue fluids has reached a critical level. The compressed heart is struggling to pump heavy, thick, sluggish blood into the tissues. The tortured lungs are making a frantic effort to gasp even one small gulp of air. He can feel the chill of death creeping through his tissues. Finally, he can allow his body to die. All of this the Bible records with four simple words from Mark 15:24. And they crucified him. That's all it says. Doesn't provide all this information that Dr. Davis, a medical doctor, provides. And then he adds his own conclusion, what wondrous love is this? Now, it is true, other men besides Jesus were crucified. And they were men who lasted longer on the cross than did the 6 hours Jesus was there. But none of them were innocent. That is to say, none of them were without sin. None of them were without deceit in their mouth. They were all human. And he is human, divine, bearing it for the sins of everyone, past, present, and future, who will come onto this planet. And feeling the burden of that perhaps even more than he did the physical torture. He himself, notice that, he himself, all alone, on the cross, so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness, for by his wounds we are healed. Again, a reference to Isaiah 53. I've said before that there's really no adequate way for a preacher to describe, or anyone, in my opinion, to describe the reality of blow-by-blow crucifixion. Very grateful for the work of this good man, who, by the way, in that source I quoted, provides about 6 or 7 pages additional information about the physical impact of the crucifixion, besides the mental, emotional, and certainly spiritual drama that is going on there. Peter comes to a close of this chapter with this statement, "For you were continually straying like sheep," which of course required the cross. "Now you have returned to the shepherd and the guardian," or in the translation that Chance read, the overseer. The word for guardian is episkopos, which is where we get the word presbytery or presbyterian. It refers to an overseer. But let's think first of the shepherd. The shepherd was the most favored image of God among the Jewish people in the Old Testament. Not simply because our favorite psalm, and that of the entire world, is Psalm 23. And he begins with, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." I believe Peter is referring here perhaps to the entire Godhead, but definitely God the Father. He's referring to what Jesus has done for us. But he says, you're continually straying from God, like sheep who do not have a shepherd. But now, if you're talking to faithful Christians now you have returned to the shepherd. It was the duty of the shepherd to lead and to feed and to protect at the cost of his own life each member of his flock. And he did. That's why the shepherd is the hero. One reason why the Jews so loved David is because he too was a shepherd and wrote that beautiful shepherd psalm by inspiration. Psalm 100, we are his people and the sheep of his pasture. If you don't take that to heart as a child of God, then you desperately need to. And then this matter of guardian. The word for guardian, the shepherd obviously is from a farming background. The word for guardian is really more from a civic leader background. It refers to that person who is in charge of a village, who is in charge of a community, who is in charge even of a town or a city. It is his job to provide. It is his job to protect. Now, he's not the only one, but he is the one in charge. It would be comparable to those who are local leaders right here in Metro Henderson as well as Chester County. It refers to those who are in the governor's position and those who are in the president's position and all of that. It is their job to provide and to protect and to lead in the right way, to lead in that which is right. And so these two precious terms, Peter refers to God Almighty and says, with all of this going for you, I know you're mistreated as slaves. I've been mistreated as well, and you know he will be again by being executed by the Romans. I've also mistreated, including direct mistreatment of my Lord. But it is his love that cares for us. It is his power that protects us. It is his wisdom that guides us in every way that is right. And so tonight, it is a humble privilege, but an honor of the highest level that really none of us deserve, to be able to remind you of some of these truths and to encourage us to be responsive to them. There may be someone here who has not yet become a child of God by being born again by faith and baptism. There may be someone here who needs to come back to the faith, needs to come back to the fold. You're outside the fold, lost, without hope. And for all of us, we can do better. I would encourage us this. If we've mistreated someone, let's make it right. Let's make it right. That may require a public visit. And the person may be scared to death or wondering, what in the world? And yet, we'll probably be the first to shed tears when things are made right. And there certainly are things that need to be right in our relationship with God. I'm positive of that. We're all human. We're all made of dust. And the Lord remembers that. That's why he's so patient with us, so long-suffering with us. But he also expects us to be responsible and accountable. And that is why. That is the shepherd and guardian of our souls, he extends the invitation as we stand and sing.